Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf. Sorry I've been away so long, but life, the universe, and everything, you know how it goes. In any case, today we'll be talking with Chris Donnelly, author of Doc, Donnie, the Kid, and Billy Brawl, how the 1985 Mets and Yankees fought for New York's baseball soul. Now, Donnelly has written about the Yankees before. His previous books include How the Yankees Explain New York, and Baseball's Greatest Series, Yankees-Mariners and the 1995 matchup that changed history. So, regarding New York, a lot of people think New York has no soul, but the conversation between New York Mets and Yankees fans has been going on ever since the New York Mets and Yankees have been going on, with George Steinbrenner taking over the team in the early 70s. He wanted the Yankees to be owners of New York when it came to baseball and was never happy when the Mets had any kind of success. And in the mid-80s, the Mets were enjoying more success than they had in several years. So here is our conversation with Chris Donnelly. Chris Donnelly, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me back, Ron.
So congratulations on your new book, another book that involves the Yankees. But this one's a little different in that it involves the Mets as well. Now, I'm going out on a limb and saying that you are, if not a Yankee fan, a Yankee follower?
I am indeed a Yankee fan, yes. But don't let that fool anyone. The book is, there's no bias in the book, especially if you read it, as you'll see from the Yankees, and there's certainly no favoritism in it.
No, I mean, I was very impressed in that it is very much pro-Mets. You know, the Mets did have a fantastic year. Just as a reminder to the readers, the book is titled Doc, Donnie, the Kid, and Billy Brawl, How the 1985 Mets and Yankees Fought for New York's Baseball Soul. Was this the first time they fought for baseball soul?
I think so. I mean, you know, the Mets came about in 1962 and were sort of the lovable losers, but it didn't really make New York a Mets town. At the time, it was still a Yankees town. The Yankees had won or were in the process of winning and going to the World Series for several consecutive years. And then the Yankees fell off in the late 60s, but the Mets weren't that great either. And then they had the season of 1969, of course, the amazing Mets. But they didn't really follow up 69 with much success. Even the 73 team, which went to the World Series, they weren't a great team, if you look at their regular season record and their performance, but they still managed to make the World Series, but there was never really continuing momentum enough where the Mets could truly capture New York. And then by the late 70s, you have the Bronx Zoo era, and even though the Yankees are chaotic, they're winning championships. And so by and large, New York was either a Yankees town or a neither team town until the mid-1980s, and really 85 is where the two teams meet in the middle, one team going up, the Mets, one team going down, the Yankees. 85, the middle of the decade, just happens to be where they intersect, and it's where the Mets truly start to begin to take over the city and make it a Mets town.
Now, just going back for a little bit, we were talking about the 1962 Mets. New York had been without a National League team for a couple of years. Do you know how the Yankees felt about that? Were they happy to be, in a matter of speaking, the only game in town?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I can imagine. I mean, ownership back then was different than it was, obviously, with George Steinbrenner when he was in charge. And I think, to some degree, look, when the Giants and Dodgers left town, I would be shocked to learn that many of their fan base went over to the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can tell you just from my family's own experience that they were all Giants fans, and they would be damned if they were going to root for the Yankees, even if that meant they didn't root for any baseball teams. And so I don't know if there was that big of an impact on the Yankees per se, especially because the Mets were so awful, and they were playing in the Polo Grounds, which at that point was really just a dump of the stadium. And, of course, they had the grand Yankee Stadium, and they were winning championships, and they had all these marquee players. So I don't know if it was that big of a concern at the beginning. It certainly became a concern once George Steinbrenner took over the team, to the point where it was an obsession, especially after the Mets started to become competitive. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that George got to a point where he was more concerned with what the Mets were doing and with winning the back pages than necessarily about whether the Yankees were winning.
Do you think it was a matter of money, like the Mets were siphoning off people who might otherwise have gotten Yankee games, or is it merely a matter of pride for Steinbrenner?
I think it was more, I think Steinbrenner just had that personality where he wanted to win and needed to dominate. I don't know if it was necessarily about money. I'm sure to some degree that was part of it because George didn't want to lose fans to the Mets and didn't want to lose tickets to the Mets and cable viewers. But I think just based on his personality, it was the idea that anybody would come in and would be a serious challenge to his team being the dominant team in New York. George got to a point where he was fudging the attendance numbers. Because the Mets were drawing so well and the Yankees weren't, and he would lie. I mean, he would straight up lie about how many people were attending games, and then at the end of the year, any game in which the attendance figure ended in a 7, he knew was a fudge number, and then the staff would have to go back and put in the real number. And he obsessed about spring training games against
the
Mets.
Right,
and,
I was going to say that.
The Yankees had to win those games, especially because more often than not, those games were being broadcast back home in New York, and so he would insist on, Yankee players would have to walk on eggshells when the Mets were in town, because if they screwed up, if they made a mistake, if they didn't look like they were giving their all, they were going to hear it from George. And I mean, some players' careers were determined in spring training not by their overall performance, but by how they would do against the Mets, or how they would do in front of George's friends if they were in town. And some people were banished forever to the minor leagues because of it. It was just this unhealthy obsession that just so happened to take place while George was at his manic worst. And, is chicken or the egg, which came first? Was George manic because of the Mets, was he playing into this and becoming even more manic because the Mets were so great? But either way, it resulted in the Yankees' downfall in the mid to late 80s.
The Mets and Yankees used to play a mid-season game called the Mayor's Trophy game. Sure Steinbrenner felt even more strongly about that because that was in the middle of the season. You couldn't blame fringe players anymore because these were the real rosters playing. Do you remember? I don't remember. When did that stop? When did the Mayor's Trophy game stop?
I believe it stopped somewhere in the mid-80s. It's somewhere along the 80s, I believe it stopped. I don't recall them ever playing that game in the 90s, and I think there was a degree of relief for a lot of people who were on the Yankees that they no longer had to participate in it because it was a no-win situation for them. Mm-hmm. They were supposed to win, so if they won, they really didn't get any kudos, and then if they lost, then there was hell to pay for losing to the Mets on this big stage.
That was a big stage because it was not played in Florida. It was played right in New York.
Right.
Talk about the business a little bit more. You write in the book about some questionable advertising campaigns done by the Mets to try to win, again, the hearts and souls of the fans. When did these advertising really start? Because I can't imagine the Yankees being in a position. They must have felt, well, we don't have to advertise. We're the Yankees. At what point did this was the 80s about when this all started?
Yeah, it started in the early 80s when the Mets were still a really bad team, and they ran this advertising campaign that said the Magic is back, which was essentially laughed at because the Magic wasn't back. I mean, the Mets were still bad teams, and actually opposing players would laugh when they would see these advertisements because they would say, what Magic? These guys are still terrible. And really, what the Mets would advertise on the Magic is back team, but they would also advertise on opposing players coming into shape, that it was the best way that they could get new fans to come to the stadium. When Fernando Mania was happening, the Mets would advertise around that, and Joe Torre actually talked about how sick he got of having to see billboards for opposing players to try and lure fans to Shea. But part of that also, the Yankees didn't necessarily feel they needed like advertising, and George Steinbrenner made comments to that effect, but it definitely caught their attention. I mean, nothing the Mets did got past George, and as part of this advertising plan, there were comments, especially from Frank Cashin, that really pissed George off, basically equating the neighborhood around the South Bronx to a war zone and an unsafe place, and George got wind of that and demanded an apology, and of course Frank Cashin wasn't going to apologize, because why should he, as far as he was concerned? He wasn't obsessed with the Yankees, George was. So, I mean, the advertising campaign, I guess in some ways you could say it worked, because it certainly drew attention to the team. Whether it actually resulted in more fans coming back, I mean, I think the attendance numbers would show you that wasn't the case, because the product in the field was just a terrible product.
Did you find in your research that this back and forth feuding, did the media like that? Did it give them stuff to write about, or were they just rolling their eyes over it?
I think by that point most of them didn't like it, and I don't know if it had to do specifically with the feuding between the teams, because really it was mostly Yankees and Steinbrenner driven. The Mets weren't necessarily looking to pick fights, although I think they enjoyed the fact that Steinbrenner would always take the bait, and I think they especially enjoyed it more once the city became a Mets town.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of the writers just grew tired of Steinbrenner's antics, and especially the Steinbrenner-Billy dynamic. I think they got tired of having to be up at 1-2 in the morning to write a story about whatever had happened post-game, you know, whatever fight had happened or whatever George had said about a certain player. And I mean, it all made for good copy, but I think eventually it just wore them down because it became tiresome and they knew how it was going to play out and they didn't want to be up late writing the stuff if they didn't have to. And the Mets weren't this crazy, but they were still drawing attention to the city, so why couldn't the Yankees be the same way? So, I mean, I'm sure they enjoyed it for a period of time, but like a lot of other things, especially with the Yankees, it just became really tiresome. And I think not just the writers, but the fans and the players really just wanted to focus on baseball, and to some degree they couldn't.
I want to read a brief passage from the chapter called Hospital Management. Sure, the Yankees were also making a run for it, but the Yankees were corporate. They were a daily soap opera with villains straight out of a black and white silent movie. Steinbrenner may as well have had a handlebar mustache to twirl as he tied Billy Martin up to the railroad tracks. Meanwhile, the Mets were winning, and they were fun. They were gritty. They did not take shit from opposing teams. They partied hard, and they were cocky as the day is long. In short, the Mets were New York City in the 1980s, and New Yorkers responded in kind. Talk about a little the difference between, if you can, you're a Yankees fan, I'm a Mets fan. Talk about what are some of the demographic differences between the two.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Yankees were, it's not to say that there weren't players on the Yankees who weren't interesting characters of themselves. It's not to say that Yankee players themselves didn't know how to have a good time and have a drink and party, because they certainly did. But the drama that engulfed the Yankees kind of covered all that up, and it really wasn't, the Yankees weren't and never have been an organization that kind of highlights those after-hours activities. They've always frowned upon it. It's, you know, this famous incident at the Copacabana with Billy Martin and Mickey Mantle and that group. They've always frowned upon that kind of thing. And so they weren't as interesting to watch as the Mets, even though the Yankees had some incredible players at the time with Don Mattingly and Ricky Henderson and Dave Winfield, and they had human interest stories and Phil Negro trying to win his 300th game. But the continued off-the-field drama matched with their not winning a World Series in a couple of years, which, I mean, for the Yankees was a big deal. It may not have been for other organizations, but for them it was. It did not make them as interesting as the Mets. The Mets were, by and large, they were young, they were exciting, they were in your face. The 84 season, 83 season was a terrible one in New York, and the 84 season kind of came out of nowhere. A lot of their young talent, led by Gooden and Strawberry, emerged, and the Mets made a run for first place. And it was exciting, it was gripping, it was stuff people wanted to watch. You had this incredible pitcher, a guy who wasn't even 21 until after the 85 season, and Dwight Gooden, who just dominated hitters, and you had this Darryl Strawberry. I mean, what a great name for a baseball player, matched with that incredible talent and these these monstrous home runs that he would hit, and the speed and the arm, and match that with guys like Gary Carter and Keith Hernandez. But then you had the fun guys like McDowell and Jesse Orosco, and even somebody like a Doug Sisk, who didn't have the best relationship with fans. But these guys were partiers. They were in your face. As I said, they didn't take shit from other teams. And what we know and what we think of the 86 Mets, the drinking, the after-hours activity, the in-your-face, I mean, all that started in 85. It all began, the scum bunch began in 85. The opposing teams hating the Mets, that all began in 85 because of their cockiness. And it was just, even though they ended up with almost identical records in 85, it was two very different styles in which they went about it, and two very different, one was exciting, and the Yankees weren't necessarily exciting, except up until the very end when they were making a run for it.
Now, you mentioned, of course, Gooden and Strawberry were kind of the young backbone of the team, and it's kind of like watching a movie about actual events. You know how the story eventually turns out. It turns out quite tragically for both of them, and very sad for them as well as the fans who love them.
Right.
I don't recall anybody on the Yankees capturing the imagination as they did in those days.
Yeah, I mean, Yankees had Don Mattingly, who became this icon in New York, winning the batting title in 84 and, of course, winning the MVP in 85. And people grew to love Mattingly, not just because of the player that he was or the person that he was, but because the team ended up being so bad. And he was sort of, as Michael Kay has said, he was the one shining light in that dark tunnel through the late 80s.
But if I can interrupt for a second, he followed the traditions of people like, not to the same degree, but the people that the Yankees had in the past, like a Mantle or somebody of that nature, you know, like a perennial all-star. The Mets never had anybody like Gooden and Strawberry before, all due respect to Tom Seaver and his compatriots.
Right, that's absolutely correct, and that's one of the things that sort of captured the imagination about these two guys is the name Darryl Strawberry just hooked you in, and then you saw the home runs that he hit and the speed that he had, and it's not to say that he did not, that the issues that were going to catch up to Darryl later in his life were not already starting to emerge in terms of the moodiness. And what some of his teammates would perceive as sometimes giving up, and his head wasn't in the game. But I mean, he was just exciting to watch. You stopped what you're doing when Strawberry came to the plate because you wanted to see if he was going to hit a ball 500 feet, like the home run he hit in St. Louis mm-hmm. in September. And a guy like Gooden, I mean, we're talking about one of the greatest individual single-season pitching performances, not of the 80s or of the expansion era, of all time. 24-4, 1.53 ERA, 268 strikeouts. He was just a dominant force on the mound that year, to the point where you had players, one player on the Giants saying, he threw me a fastball that I didn't even see. It just went past me. I never actually saw it. And it was incredible to watch, and you know, I try to put it into words, but you have to actually go back and watch a video of Gooden in that 85 season to just see how overpowering he was and how overmatched hitters were. And I didn't want to dwell too much, because we all know what happens eventually. We all know that the potential was never truly lived up to. I didn't want to dwell on that too much in the book, because it was one of those enjoy the moment for what it
right.
was
sure.
kind of things versus being sad that it's passed. And, I mean, to say Gooden dominated, he had a 4.50 ERA after the first start of the year, which was on opening day. In his next start against the Reds, he dropped his ERA below 2, and it never went above 2 the rest of the year. And I know some of the statistics that I use in the book and that we measure in 85 have sort of become outdated with analytics, but I think you can still use them to see just how incredible he was that year.
Well, certainly in comparison with all his contemporaries, of course. This seems like you had fun doing this book.
I did. After I'd done my first book, which is about the 95 division series between the Yankees and Mariners, part of doing that was researching just how chaotic the Yankees were in the 80s. And it sort of struck me that there was this symmetry to the Yankees becoming terrible by the end of the decade and the Mets becoming great by the end of the decade and having won a, even though I think Mets fans would tell you they didn't fully live up to their potential, they were still perennial contenders in the East. And it just struck me that they just seemed to be equal in how both teams rose and fell. And I really wanted to look into that, and it was curious to me that nobody had ever really in-depth looked at the Mets and the Yankees as competitors or in the same story throughout their time in the city. And just looking into it and talking to guys who played on the team and hearing some of the stories and reliving the soap opera, I mean, as a fan in 85, it probably was not fun if you were on the Yankees. And as a Mets fan, you sort of dwell on what maybe never truly happened with guys like Strawberry and Gooden. But to go back and see all these things and hear these stories, I mean, I did have a lot of fun doing it. It took me several years to write this book because I had to put it on the shelf for a little while. But to get it done and to see the narrative and how everything played out, I really, truly enjoyed it. And I love the story.
And the story is called Doc Donnie the Kid and Billy Brawl, how the 1985 Mets and Yankees fought for New York's baseball soul. Chris Donnelly, thank you for talking with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Ron.
And that was our baseball conversation with Chris Donnelly. Hard to believe, but we're coming up on 100 of these conversations. I hope you're enjoying them as much as I have working on them. I wish I could work on them more frequently because there's so many wonderful people out there who love the game and express that love via books or music or films. In any case, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews, please check out Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com. If you have any questions or suggestions, please drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. Have a great holiday, and I'll talk to you soon. So long.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."